Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival this summer. For Music at Menlo's 13th season, we'll explore, with a more concentrated focus than in any previous summer, the life and work of one of history's most extraordinary musical figures, the Austrian composer Franz Schubert. In addition to ranking among history's most cherished musical voices, Schubert remains one of Western music's most fascinating and confounding figures. The only composer of the Viennese canon native to that city, Schubert represents a bridge from the classical era to the Romantic generation. Born in 1797, 12 years before the death of the father of the classical style, Joseph Haydn, Schubert lived but an ephemeral life. Beethoven, the composer whom he most revered, was 26 years his senior. Their deaths were separated by just 20 months. But what Schubert accomplished in his short life is astonishing. He enjoyed recognition in his lifetime for only a small part of his staggering output, the gradual revelation in the decades after his death of what he had done is unprecedented among the great composers. In addition to his epic contributions to the piano, chamber, and orchestral literature, his oeuvre of more than 600 lieder revolutionized the genre, transforming it into one of the Romantic era's essential art forms. And as illness forced him to confront his mortality before his 30th birthday, Schubert, who once claimed, "I have come into the world for no purpose but to compose," produced a stream of masterpieces unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. Nearly two centuries after his death, Schubert's place in the pantheon is secure, but his music continues unceasingly to offer new discoveries and immense rewards. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by artistic co-director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. This summer at Music at Menlo, we unveil a new series. In previous seasons, the festival's main concert programs have been complemented by the Carte Blanche concert series of artist-curated recitals. This season, as a means of truly sharpening our focus on the extraordinary life and art of Franz Schubert, in place of the Carte Blanche concerts, we present a series of five Schubertiads. Schubertiads, which originated during Schubert's life, were social gatherings in private residences that included readings, dancing, dining, and the music of Schubert. They were often hosted by the members of the Schubert Circle, his close circle of friends, young men roughly his age, mostly artists and poets themselves, who simply could not get enough of Schubert's music and were eager to hear his latest magical creations. Schubert biographer and Music at Menlo encounter leader Christopher H. Gibbs has described Schubertiads as certainly events, but also perhaps a state of mind. The audiences at the Schubertiads could range from a small group to over 100 listeners. Schubert's close friend Leopold Kupelwieser once wrote to his friends while he was in Rome, quote, "I treat myself to a Schubertiad now and again," end quote, offering a warm image of a one-person Schubertiad. This summer at Music at Menlo, we'll revive the concert tradition that entranced Schubert's most loyal audiences.
This summer's first concert program, Genius Ignited, documents Schubert's explosive burst of creativity in the fall of 1814. Over the next 15 months, he completed two string quartets, two symphonies, two masses, and more than 150 songs. His staggering productivity continued into 1816, with nearly 100 more songs, the fourth and fifth symphonies, another mass, and various chamber pieces, including a set of three sonatinas for violin and piano. We will encounter these three important early works this summer at the Schubert Theater.
Schubert composed the three sonatinas for violin and piano just shortly after his 19th birthday. Their transparency and simplicity of character betray the influence of Mozart on the adolescent Schubert. This season's first Schubertiade begins with the Sonatina No. 1 in D major. The second and third sonatinas, in A minor and G minor respectively, appear on Schubertiade 2. Schumann once referred to Schubert's gift for melody as compressed lyrical insanity. The A minor sonatina's opening bears witness to this element of Schubert's music. The piano introduces the theme, a subdued melody presented above a straightforward accompaniment in the left hand. But when the violin enters, the melody becomes unhinged, marked by wide leaps and dynamic extremes. Violinist Philip Setzer.
When you listen, even in this early A minor sonatina, he's written before he was in his 20s, 18 or 19 years old, you hear a sense of innocence in the aspect of the texture, which is quite transparent. That's another element of Schubert that you immediately are drawn to. If I were to play a similar kind of place in music of Beethoven and then play it on Schubert, you would notice immediately the transparency of the texture. And I think this again has to do with his sense of the piano and his sense of accompanying the melody. The naturalness of the melodic line is certainly the first thing that I would notice. We also have a tremendous harmonic sense in Schubert. The most beautiful moments in Schubert are always moments when he modulates unexpectedly from one key to another. And these very special moments, the ones that give us goosebumps or give us chills, are modulations that are very much Schubert's and no one else's. For me, what makes something like the A minor sonatina so special are these incredibly beautiful modulations from one key to another, or surprising chords or added notes in the chords. There's just a sensuality to the harmonies themselves going along with these beautiful melodies that make Schubert so special.
Well, Schubert is well known as one of the earlier romantic composers, and I think what sets him off from his predecessors in a way is a very delicate and very great awareness for the melody and for all things lyrical.
Cellist Dmitri Atapin.
Also, he is extremely creative with the harmony, and he's very creative with the new ways of coloring familiar motifs or familiar things, sometimes more adventurous than his predecessors, although not exactly forthcoming. So it's not something obvious, it's something hidden in the texture.
Thank you.
I very much delight in listening to Schubert's divine melodies and into his very intimate and very delicate way of coloring and nuancing a never-returning melody, for example, with slightly different accompaniment and slightly different coloration that is extremely inventive. He's, of course, very famous as the early great composer of the Lied. Beethoven certainly wrote a few Lieders, but Schubert comes to mind as this great first composer that explores the beauty of the human voice to its fullest. And I think a lot of that characteristic goes into a lot of his chamber music, special propensity and special delicacy with the tunes and with the all things melodious.
Naturally, alongside Schubert's instrumental chamber works, each of this summer's Schubertiads will feature a selection of the Lieder that cemented his reputation as Western music's Prince of Song.
His magnificent accomplishments in virtually every other musical genre notwithstanding, Schubert's Lieder, which number more than 600 and set texts by more than 150 poets, unquestionably represent his most significant contribution to the repertoire. While much of Schubert's music went unrecognized during his lifetime, his songs for voice and piano were frequently performed, primarily at the Schubertiads, intimate affairs centered on Schubert's music. And they were cherished by all who heard them. Robert Winter has written that, quote, Schubert's uniqueness lay in his ability to fuse poetry and music in ways that seem not only unique, but inevitable. Schubert's songs can withstand the closest scrutiny because they contain so many layers of meaning and stylistic intersection. End quote.
You know, actually, before Schubert, there was nothing like what he did.
Pianist Gilbert Kalisch.
I mean, I've done beautiful, wonderful Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven songs. It was all kind of taking baby steps in a way. The kind of word coloring that Schubert does is like a huge innovation. I mean, it's not that the words and music in Mozart or Haydn were irrelevant to one another, but this is so closely allied with it and so beautifully reflective one of the other. You can have the music and you know what the words are in a way. I mean, it was a kind of unique gift to be able to take words and to fit them with music that sounded so much like what the meaning of the words was.
Schubert's innovations to the art song elevated the entire genre, transforming it from simple domestic fare into a musical form of primary importance for composers of the Romantic generation and beyond. They are his legacy, rightly earning him the sobriquet, the Prince of Song. Schubert's friend Josef von Spaun perhaps best summarized his legacy as a composer of Lieder. Quote, in this category he stands unexcelled, even unapproached. Every one of his songs is in reality a poem on the poem he set to music. Who among those who had the good fortune to hear some of his greatest songs does not remember how this music made a long familiar poem new for him, how it was suddenly revealed to him and penetrated his very depth? End quote.
What makes a song so special is what makes Schubert so special, is that he can say so much with so little.
Pianist Inon Barnaton.
Because, the songs, when you're dealing with such a short format and such an intimate mode of expression, you need to be able to say a lot with very little. And he manages, with the most simple change of harmony, the most simple turn of phrase, to completely convey a whole depth of meaning. You get such a complex experience from very simple means. And that's incredible. Some of my favorite Schubert songs are only a minute long. And they can be just a few chords and a simple melody, and they break your heart. And there are very few composers that can do that.
Violinist Aaron Boyd.
For me, Schubert's music is the music that touches me the most deeply. I was playing a concert not long ago for some younger people, and they said, "Wait, what music do you listen to?" "Well, I don't listen to pop." "What do I listen to?" "If I am home alone and want to be moved, I listen to the Lieder of Schubert, because this is the music that touches me the most."
Following the D major sonatina for violin and piano, this summer's first Schubertiad offers a set of Lieder likewise dating from Schubert's miracle years of 1814 to 1816. The set begins with Lieb Minna, on words by Schubert's friend Albert Stadler. The poem portrays Minna, a young woman mourning her lover, Wilhelm, who has fallen in battle. Schubert's setting, at once tearful, haunting, and heartrending, breathes life into Stadler's text. Schubert's Wiegenlied, or Lullaby, follows. The pianist Graham Johnson has written, quote, "This beautiful little melody seems the most quintessential, the most fragile, the most heartfelt Schubert, and yet, on paper, it is hardly more than an oscillation between tonic and dominant. When Schubert's music is on this plane, it has an inevitability and economy which every single composer since must have envied."
The Lieder on this summer's second Schubertiad include one of Schubert's finest and best-loved songs, Im Frühling, or In Spring.
"Quietly I sit on the hill slope. The sky is so clear. A breeze plays in the green valley where I was at spring's first sunbeam once. Ah, I was so happy. Where I walked at her side, so intimate and so close. And deep in the dark rocky spring was the beautiful sky, blue and bright. And I saw her in the sky."
Still sitz ich an des Hügels Hang, der Himmel ist so klar, das Lüftchen spielt.
The character of the music changes for the penultimate stanza.
"The only things that change are will and illusion. Joys and quarrels alternate. The happiness of love flies past, and only the love remains. The love and, the sorrow.
Es wandelt nur sich viel und an, es wechsellos durch Zeit.
But the song's final verse returned to the idyllic reverie of the opening.
Oh, if only I were a little bird there on the meadow's slope, then I would remain here on these branches and sing a sweet song about her the whole summer long.
Süßes Lied von ihr den ganzen Sommer lang.
On the summer's third Schubertiad, we hear one of Schubert's most haunting songs, Death and the Maiden. The song takes on a motif dating back to the Renaissance, in which death is depicted as a dangerous seducer, coaxing a young maiden away from earthly life. Schubert's lead begins with a dirge-like sequence of chords. The song sets a poem by Matthias Claudius, in which the maiden urges death.
Pass me by, oh, pass me by. Go, fierce man of bones. I am still young. Go, rather, and do not touch me.
Forever, ah, forever, give in the Knochen, Mann. Ich bin noch jung. Geh lieber und rühre mich nicht an.
Death replies,
give me your hand, your beautiful and tender form. I am a friend and come not to punish. Be of good cheer. I am not fierce. Softly shall you sleep in my arms.
Gib deine Hand, du schön und zart Gebild. Bin Freund und komme nicht zu Strafe. Sei gutes Mut.
Immediately following Schubert's lead, this summer's third Schubertiad concludes with the harrowing string quartet in D minor, known by the same name, Death and the Maiden. The Death and the Maiden Quartet, composed in 1824, completes the magnificent triptych of quartets composed late in Schubert's life. the quartet in A minor, also composed in 1824, and the G major quartet, composed in 1826, appear on this summer's main concert programs. Together, these three can rightfully be heard as Schubert's entry into the arena of Beethoven's Razumovsky quartets. Together, they represent his crowning achievement in the string quartet medium.
But within the quartets themselves, there is this heightened drama, this darkness and light.
Violinist Aaron Boyd.
And I will say, I think the most distinctly Schubertian quality is the near obsession with death. Death is a quality which, of course, is in the Death and the Maiden Quartet, but it's in all of those late works. It's a new and very serious and very mature Schubert. And so there is this quality of death being near all the time, chasing, either chasing him or him chasing it. But that's, for me, the most overwhelming sense. You could take the Death and the Maiden Quartet, for example, which gets its title because in the slow movement is itself a set of variations on a melody from a song with that title, Death and the Maiden. And curiously, Schubert only uses the death part of the song and builds a series of unforgettable variations from that. And the last movement is this breathless tarantella, which we all know the implications of a tarantella.
The tarantella, a traditional Italian folk dance, takes its name from the southern Italian town of Taranto, which also gives the tarantula its name. This shared etymology explains the spurious legend that the tarantella's frenetic tempo was designed to exorcise the poison caused by a spider bite.
And it is for Schubert this dance either with or running from death, trying to escape it. And it is a failure. Death wins in the end.
Of Schubert's life produced two of the composer's most magnificent contributions to the chamber literature, the piano trios in B-flat major opus 99 and E-flat major opus 100, as well as the single movement nocturnal in E-flat major DA 97. The nocturnal was likely intended as the slow movement to the B-flat trio. Removed from this role, it remains as a single movement corollary to this remarkable chapter of Schubert's creative life. This summer's fourth Schubertiad begins with the luminescent nocturnal.
Dmitri Atapin.
It is a very late work of 1827. I think it has a lot to do, in the sense of its mood, it has a lot to do with the slow movements of both the trios, and also I feel that it has a relationship to the great slow movement of the double cello quintet. I think this movement has this deceptive title of Notturno that gives it maybe this kind of a miniature feel, but at almost 10 minutes in length, it is definitely comparable to the great adagios that Schubert wrote in his late works. It has an incredible sense of serenity in its opening and closing sections. It has an incredible use of strings for me, because the strings are always doubled in this gorgeous oscillating thirds or sixes of harmony. So it is almost like two lines that are becoming one. And this melody that Schubert unfolds is not exactly a melody, but also has this arpeggiated quality to it. It makes me think of water, it makes me think of brooks, and it makes me think of forests. And I find it an extremely profound and exquisite movement. It transports the listener out of time and out of place and just suspends us in time and fills our ears with gorgeous harmonies. The closing of the movement, when the main motif comes back for the last time, is of a special beauty for me, because he combines the opening with this nightingale-like, bird-like figuration in the upper register of the piano that just infuses the music with this kind of nighttime longing, mystic quality. Also the way that he suspends the harmony, lingering in this minor and slightly saddened and melancholy mood at the end of the movement, is also something that really talks to the late Schubert and to the kind of a eternal quality of this music.
A pair of songs in the A major duo for violin and piano. The program concludes with Schubert's piano trio in B flat major, opus 99.
Schubert likely composed the B flat piano trio, the first of his two major trios, during the summer or early fall of 1827. Like many of his works, the trio was neither published nor publicly performed until after the composer's death, though it did receive a private performance by some of Vienna's elite musicians in January of 1828. Despite the composer's failing health during the time of its composition, the trio is a bright and optimistic work. Robert Schumann wrote of the trio, quote, "One glance, and the troubles of our human existence disappear, and all the world is fresh and bright again," end quote. Though composed within a traditional classical framework, this trio foreshadows the expressive subjectivity and formal liberties that would come to mark the music of the Romantic period. The first movement is in sonata form, the predominant musical structure of the classical and Romantic periods, which comprises three distinct sections: the exposition, the development, and the recapitulation. The exposition presents the movement's central musical ideas. Following the exuberant opening theme, Schubert introduces the movement's lyrical second theme in the expressive upper register of the cello. After the exposition, the movement's themes are transformed in various ways in the development section. In the recapitulation, the themes introduced in the exposition return, as if coming home after a soul-searching journey. Among other things, that journey through the development section typically involves passing through several keys. One important facet of the recapitulation is that it brings the music back to the home key, in this case, B-flat major. But Schubert's flexible treatment of sonata form in this trio looks beyond classical convention. Following the development section, Schubert takes a circuitous route to the recapitulation. After putting his thematic materials through their paces, he throws the listener a pair of false recapitulations. That is, he returns to the opening theme two times in the wrong key before finally coming home to B-flat major. It's a bit like the prodigal son mistakenly ringing the wrong doorbell twice before finally finding his father's house. In music, it's a subtle bit of trickery, as it takes a very keen ear to realize initially that when the theme comes back, we've actually entered the wrong house. We're not in the home key of B-flat major at all, but G-flat major. And then D-flat major. And then finally, B-flat major. The melodic genius made manifest in Schubert's 600-plus Lieder permeates his instrumental music as well. The trio's second movement Andante begins with one of Schubert's most inspired melodies, a tender, poetic statement, again using the high range of the cello. Schubert offsets the Andante's poignancy with the skittish scherzo. The final movement fulfills the promise of spring offered in the trio's first movement. The musicologist Alfred Einstein has noted the resemblance of this melody to one of Schubert's songs composed in 1815 on the following text. Let us in the bright May morning take delight in the brief life of the flower before its fragrance disappears.
This season's final Schubertiad begins with the only work on the series by a composer other than Schubert. We'll hear the final string quartet by the composer whom Schubert most revered, the Quartet in F Major, Opus 135, by Ludwig van Beethoven.
Beethoven's string quartet in F Major, Opus 135, the last of his monumental cycle of 16 quartets, represents the composer's final period, during which he created what many consider to be his most profound works. Opus 135 returns to the classical four-movement structure used in the early quartets, but within this guise of Haydnesque simplicity is contained the unmistakable depth of Beethoven. After completing his last symphony and his last piano sonata, Beethoven turned once again, after a 12-year hiatus, to the string quartet as the medium for his deepest musical thoughts. The quartets to which Beethoven devoted his final years represent the pinnacle of the composer's mighty creative powers and infinite imagination. In these five late quartets, his opuses 127, 130, 131, 132, and 135, Beethoven surpassed all precedent for the expressive capabilities of music, as if transcending this world and composing for listeners of future generations. After the increasing structural innovations of the first four of the late quartets, opuses 127, 130, 132, and 131, which comprise respectively 4, 5, 6, and 7 movements, opus 135 returns to a standard classical four-movement architecture, similar to the opus 18 quartets composed when Beethoven was in his late 20s. The quartet begins with a quiet conversation between the individual voices of the ensemble. It almost sounds as if the four instruments are tentatively looking around the room to see if it's safe to begin. Just when it sounds like the quartet has found its footing, a mysterious, disjointed melody follows, uttered in quiet octaves. But this quickly leads to a more extroverted passage. Another warmer musical idea follows. Beethoven introduces yet another subject, this one the most assertive yet, juxtaposing playful triplet figures with an ascending staccato statement. And then, what sounds like a closing figure to the exposition of the movement brings us to a reminiscence of the quiet introduction. Now, there's a lot going on in just those first couple of minutes of music. Lots of different musical ideas that Beethoven weaves together, each with its own character. Yet, somehow, despite their disparate characters, there's an uncanny logic to how the music unfolds. And then, in the movement's development section, Beethoven just completely has his way with the material he's introduced. He extends and fragments the different motifs, combines them in different ways. The mastery with which Beethoven explores these different ideas is just remarkable. Let's hear a little bit of the development section, and listen for how Beethoven casts the various gestures from the beginning of the movement in new guises. Following a raucous vivace second movement and a stunningly beautiful slow movement comes the finale, for which the Opus 135 Quartet is perhaps most famous. On the manuscript of the final movement, Beethoven inscribed the following title, Der schwer gefasste Entschluss, the resolution reached with difficulty. And accompanying the movement's mysterious opening three-note melody, Beethoven famously wrote the words, Muss es sein? Must it be? The answer is provided by the inversion of this figure, which begins the Allegro canon and under which Beethoven wrote, Es muss sein, it must be. The story goes that an amateur musician named Ignaz Dempscher had missed the Schuppanzich Quartet's premiere of the Opus 130 string quartet and requested free copies of the work from Beethoven for a performance in his home. Offended by the request, Beethoven sent word that Dempscher should pay Schuppanzich the price of admission for the concert he had missed. Dempscher asked the violinist Karl Holz, who at this time was working as Beethoven's secretary, Muss es sein? And Beethoven replied with this now immortal four-voiced canon.
Schubert's final three piano sonatas exhibit a level of artistic genius that, even for Schubert's legendary precocity, is utterly astounding. Each sonata inhabits its own distinct musical world, but the three are nevertheless bound together by a sublimity of conception and construction. Heard in the context of Schubert's death just 1 month after the completion of these works, It is tempting to speculate as to what music may have been yet to come. Had the composer lived to be as old as Bach or Haydn, or even Beethoven, who died at 57, might the year 1828 have heralded the dawning of yet a more sophisticated stage in Schubert's music? These sonatas suggest an exquisitely tantalizing answer. At this summer's Schubertiads, we'll hear each of these three late masterpieces. Wuhan plays the sonata in A major on Schubertiad II. Gilles Vansattel offers the sonata in C minor on Schubertiad III. And the series concludes with the sonata in B-flat major performed by Gilbert Kalisch.
Two of these three sonatas, the sonatas in A major and B-flat major, were first heard at Musik at Menlo in 2006 when they were performed by the pianist Claude Frank. And these sonatas are such intensely personal works that, in addition to their sheer expressive power, they give us now an opportunity for a personal gesture. Claude Frank was one of the finest and most sensitive artists of his generation and a cherished member of the Musik at Menlo family. Mr. Frank passed away this past December, 3 days after his 89th birthday. In 2006, I had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Frank about Schubert's late piano sonatas. It was long enough ago that a lot of you listening to this now might not have heard that season's audio notes, or even if you did, Mr. Frank's eloquence and insight into this music are eminently worth revisiting. So, in tribute both to some of the most profound music ever written, and to one of the greatest artists of the last century, here's Mr. Frank on Schubert's late piano sonatas.
We have the last two Schubert sonatas.
We have the last two Schubert sonatas, that's right. Well, I feel very privileged about being able to talk, to play them and talk to them. Whereby I think the playing is the more important. The talking to them can go on forever and mean nothing, but I hope it'll mean something.
Well, it's actually quite an appropriate sequel to your performance from last summer, because you had the final sonata of Beethoven, and now you'll have these two works that were completed just weeks before Schubert's death.
In fact, that's one of the most outstanding things about him, about Schubert and his last sonatas, that he was really not at all internally influenced by Beethoven, internally. Externally, of course, he was, you know, uh-huh. He knew Beethoven was great and to be admired and so on, but his sonatas, his last sonatas, were so totally different from Beethoven's sonatas.
How would you characterize Schubert's contribution to the solo piano literature?
Totally unique, totally in as much as he brought the song literature in it, later on very much, and earlier too. For example, when you think of his early sonatas, the B major sonata, which I think he wrote at age 19 or 20. In structure, it's totally classical. It's a first theme and a second theme and a development and a recapitulation and another second theme and so on. In structure, it's Haydn-esque or Mozart-esque very much. But when you think of a thing like the second movement, four phrases, third phrase, and the fourth phrase, then he develops the movement. Then at the end of the movement, as a little sort of an epilogue, he repeats those four phrases, but everyone in a different key. Now that somebody not even Beethoven had done. He does. Then. Totally different key. Third phrase, again a different key. Oh, one can't even recognize it. And the fourth phrase. Ends in the same key as he began. A very, very romantic way of dealing with that material that hadn't been used, not even by Beethoven.
And this was when Schubert was
19 or 20.
If you can speak to his methods of development already when we get from Mozart to Beethoven, it's quite a departure in how material is developed.
Indeed.
In Beethoven, you have the Fifth Symphony, of course, such a classic example of how he was able to take such a small motif,
tiny thing,
and
yes,
turn it into something enormous. Right. Can you comment on Schubert's manner of development as he succeeds Mozart and Beethoven?
Yeah, but it's quite different. He's totally different from the principle. Mm-hmm. He takes his themes, be they long and songful, and anybody would think it's impossible and cannot make a sonata out of this one, cannot make a long piece out of it. But he did. He juxtaposed the theme. Somebody once said it very nicely, but in a very literary way. He said, where Beethoven multiplies his motives and his themes, Schubert adds them. It's a nice way of putting it. It's not the same kind of internal compulsion that Beethoven has, that one expects of a development composer to do. No, Schubert takes his themes, takes them one by one, and makes an inevitable whole out of it. The A major that I play first is, it's like a symphonic movement. Where the opening material lends itself to more symphonic treatment, which it then gets. Then the so-called second theme, that's where the theme comes in. But it comes in such a way where inevitable one expects a theme and one gets a theme. And it takes the theme and it develops that theme. So this first movement is more symphonic in character, also very singular, very individual.
Now you're touching on something that actually is similarly appropriate to a discussion of the Beethoven late sonatas, which is a sense of drama.
That a sense of drama, yeah. Beethoven does something totally different in his late sonatas from what he had done, but it's not basically vocal, whereas the Schubert treatment is basically vocal. The second movement is quite unusual in the A major. It is not a lyrical movement. It's a highly dramatic movement, beginning in F sharp minor. It's the kind of feeling which is very often created in his songs. A little bit of the Atlas complex of the man who's carrying the world on his shoulders, you know, that kind of thing. Very thoughtful, very sentimental in a good way, very expressive. Then comes a middle part which is highly dramatic, which comes with thunderstorm seed. Almost Wagnerian. Typical way of a storm subsiding. The storm has gone. It's now peaceful. believe it or not, in the distance, in the distance, there's still a little bit of thunderstorm. In major first, and a little thunder miles away. And then finally comes back to the original minor theme. Quite dramatic in the real sense, you know. And then the scherzo and last movement. Well, last movement is unusual. Scherzo is rather, I hate to use the word normal, but rather predictable as far as the structure is concerned. Very beautiful, but predictable. The last movement, on the other hand, is again a sonata form, a sonata rondo, like... Sounds like a wanderlied, you know, a wandering song. It does not sound like something that one has developed into a great formal structure, but it does, it does.
How would you characterize then Schubert's musical language towards the end of his life? How do they stand apart both from Mozart and Beethoven mm-hmm. coming before him, and also from the romantic generation that was to follow, Brahms and Schumann and Dvorak and such?
They completely stand apart. Totally stand apart, because while they are, well, they're sonatas, of course. First of all, we have to know what does it mean, sonatas? You know, it means a sound one, a sounded one. Mm-hmm. And from a certain period on in the 18th century, every long piece was called a sonata. Anything that had no title, that wasn't a dance. Mm-hmm. It was called a sonata, a sound one, has a certain kind of a shape. And what happens was that after a while, they all assumed the same kind of shape. Some, a main theme returned and another theme returned. But otherwise, they had really very, very little in common. Beethoven, of course, did a great deal to the sonata. I mean, his first sonatas were like Haydn sonatas in shape and all that. And pretty soon, already in his Opus 20, he became to be very... very individual, and started with slow movements and did all kinds of fantasies in the sonatas and so on. And later on, he went completely crazy about his thematic material, what he did with his themes and so on and so forth. Schubert, on the other hand, also became very classical and really remained very classical in the actual shape, as far as the shape is concerned. Now, in these two sonatas that I'm playing here, they both have four movements. They both have a fast movement, a slow movement, a scherzo movement, and a rondo movement. The shape, the external shape, is exactly the same. But the internal shape is something totally different. And here, Schubert did something that really nobody had done yet. He put the song into a sonata form. His song, he was, of course, as one knows, this great, great, great contribution were his hundreds of songs that were so outstanding and so totally different from anything that had happened yet. And he put those songs into the sonata form, and that particularly in the second of the two I'm playing, the last one he played. There he invented a song. One can very well imagine a beautiful Goethe text to this and a soprano singing. And goes on for a few measures. Then repeats it. And then does something else, and then comes again. It's a beautiful song. Now, what Schubert does, he takes this song melody and constructs a long, upstanding sonata movement out of it. It was quite incredible, with another theme and a development and a contrapuntal treatment and everything else, something that was very un-Schubertian in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And people have been wondering, how can he do it? But he did it, you know, he did it. So he wrote a piece which takes about 35 to 40 minutes, and out of that song makes an incredibly constructed piece. then writes a beautiful coda, which is lends from the theme, where the theme goes. And the coda goes. Utterance of the beginning and then the end. That's the first movement. The second movement is very, in structure, very similar to other second movements by Haydn, Mozart, or even Beethoven, which goes with them. Goes on and on for a while, then comes the middle part. Not unusual. Something that has happened with other composers too, that it was a little middle section of the slow movement. Then comes the first beginning again, repeated almost verbatim with a different bass, an adorned bass, and finally, as he does so often, the end of his minor movements, he writes in major, and a motive which he's had in minor, which now at the end of the movement he writes in major. In major now, in major now. And then two more chords, and that's the end of the movement. It's a magnificent invention. Nothing structurally, nothing very unusual. Just emotionally very unusual, because there's that song utterance that goes through the whole piece. Then comes a scherzo, and structurally very usual. The scherzo, two sections, a trio with two sections, the first section, second section, so the trio itself, the structure is nothing unusual, but what it does, as you've heard here, a Schubertian kind of a modulation, that and back again, and at the capo from the beginning. So, again, structurally nothing unusual, but emotionally, of course, harmonically very, very unusual, very inventive. And when that's over, comes the last movement. Which is what now the musicologists call a sonata, a rondo sonata form. In other words, it's that theme that keeps on coming back because it's a very popular and very nice theme, but it has sonata structure. Again, in structure, there's nothing unusual. Nothing unusual. It's the way Beethoven had done it in his middle period, the way Haydn and Mozart had done it. But emotionally, of course, what he does, what themes he brings, quite different, quite unusual, quite inventive, and tremendously emotional, tremendously songful. At the same time as being courageous. That's what's so great about Schubert. No matter how sentimental, in quotes sentimental, I mean that in a good sense, he is, there's always one moment with him that says, but we must be strong. As he does in the B-flat sonata. as if to say, life must go on. And that's always the case with him. No matter how sentimental he is, no matter how desperate he is, as he is in his famous winter journey, where he's really talking about death and disappearance all the time, there's always a moment of strength in him. These are the things, you know, people, we are very often asked to put our fingers on, what is it that we love so much about it? This is one of the things. I very often think, but that's only in the most extravagant parts of my thinking, is that with Mozart, one has a feeling that he died old, that he wrote everything he would have written. But one has a feeling, it's because how could he have written more? Schubert, one has a feeling he could have, probably would have written much more still.
It's quite tantalizing, actually.
Quite tantalizing. And on the other hand, the last sonatas, the ones we're talking about, there's something terribly final about them too, you know. So maybe he wouldn't have. That's a consoling thought. Maybe he wouldn't have.
Maybe we got as much out of him.
Maybe he got as much out of him as we can. Yes, exactly.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Rachel Sokolow. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Schubert's Violin Sonatina in A Minor, performed by Philip Setzer and Gilbert Kalish, Andi Musik, performed by Christopher Nomura and Derek Hahn, and Notturno, performed by Cho Liang Lin, David Finkel, and Yuho Pohonyan, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Schubert's Lieb Minna, performed by Anne Murray and Graham Johnson, Wegenlied, performed by Sarah Walker and Graham Johnson, and Der Tod und das Mädchen, performed by Brigitte Fassbender and Graham Johnson, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Schubert's Im Frühling, performed by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Gerald Moore, and Schubert's Death in the Maiden Quartet and Beethoven's String Quartet in F Major, Opus 135, performed by the Emerson String Quartet, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Schubert's Piano Trio in B-flat Major is performed by Wu Han, Philip Setzer, and David Finkel. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.